the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, a report card on the move to net zero carbon and where agriculture and farming fits into that equation. Also, it's been a fruitful harvest for apple growers in Riverina Highlands. At Batlow, the weather, labour supply and consumer demand have all come together well.
It's been a good growing season. We had good rains right through November, December and January, and then it dried up in January, February, but there was sufficient moisture in the ground for us not to have to irrigate the older trees. We did irrigate the younger trees, and in the last week we've had close to 60 millimetres of rain and one very cold day where there was a bit of a dusting of snow up on the main range. But that's the autumn in Batlow. The season, I think, has been very good. One of the better ones that I can think of.
We'll have more on that story shortly. Also, almond sales as well, a record there in regards to almonds. We'll find out what's been happening in that industry too very shortly as well. But first up, a report card on the carbon market has found that there's a strong consensus on the need to reach net zero by 2050. But urgent action is needed in the push for renewable energy and carbon payments that could provide financial incentives to drive faster change. John Connor from the Carbon Market Institute says the economic costs of inaction vastly outweigh the required investment, according to bodies like the International Monetary Fund. He says taking these essential extra steps will involve the use of carbon markets to tap into carbon stored on the farm, in the soil and in the vegetation, and might help in that fight against climate change and biodiversity loss.
This report's looking at some of the broader aspects of both industrial, agricultural and land-based changes that we need to get to the net zero that can help us play a role in minimising the climate impacts and costs. And one of the charts I've got at the start of it is the really escalating costs if we don't take action. And these are global costs from the International Monetary Fund as well, which is why nations are actually, in uneven ways, they are working and committed towards net zero, why we still have bipartisan commitment to net zero. And so the report looks at a range of few things, and particularly for your listeners, the role of the land sector that we will need there. Even though if we do get on with the broader industrial decarbonisation, there's still a key role for agriculture to reduce emissions, but also the land to play a role through sequestering carbon, you know, pulling it out of the atmosphere and vegetation and soils, potentially also other geological storages. And so this is another issue that's live out there. One of the contributors, Climate Work, says that, you know, that we might need to increase eightfold the land-based sequestration. And so there's some discussion, what does that mean? We need to have some good policy across government and build on social capital and some of the challenges that we are working through right now with the market as it is.
Talking about the roadblocks, though, I mean, landholders in terms of transmission lines and towers and things like building towers spread the renewable energy, you know, around the nation in a better way. Do you see that government has to fast track some of that? And you know, some communities are not necessarily going to be happy with that at the end of it.
Well, I think you know, this is a big transition. You know, some have been talking, and we've got the Prime Minister was launching a bigger fund in the Future Made in Australia Act. You know, many say this is as big a transition as we've had since the Industrial Revolution, and it's a decade long transition. And really, if we're going to do it, we actually need to carry the communities with us, and so it's got to be a just and sustainable one. So it's very important that you
can't just sort of ride roughshod over them.
No, we can't do this. You know, it's not something that can be done in 12 months and things. So you've got to be conscious around social capital. I know, and so that's the same as in transmission, as it is in some of the land-based sort of carbon farming operations, you know, working on the social capital, making sure that, you know, you've got a good approach to ferals and pests and fire, but also that that those benefits are flowing into the communities. So these are things that you need to be conscious of if we're going to make this transition. And I know the transmission one's been a hot one, but we just have to work our way through it. We do have to do this. It's in the broader national interest, in broader in communities in the regions as well as in the cities that we take action to reduce and minimise the climate costs.
The Greens often talk about the subsidies that the fossil fuel sector get. Do we need to look at things like that and you know, in terms of moving away from, you know, the old style economy to a new one? Do we need to change the, you know, tax base there?
Well, I mean, we've got, we've had, you know, one of the big things, of course, is that much of this sort of carbon pollution, the greenhouse gases going up there, has actually been for free. So the polluters haven't been paying. And so this is where carbon pricing, we've had a couple of goes of that here in Australia in terms of carbon pricing mechanisms, which might generate revenue or not. We do have now a safeguard mechanism that's been changed and built off the coalition's compliance mechanism, which does raise costs and is essentially a carbon cost. It's not getting revenue back into the government, though, so it's sort of people try to avoid a carbon tax. Some economists and you know, we wouldn't mind that because it actually gives you revenue to generate. But this one does have the costs increasing over time, so it's actually driving, you know, incentivizing investment in lower cost in lower emission technologies. And you know, we are seeing other countries. The US has got the Inflation Reduction Act. The EU's got a Green Deal. They are putting subsidies into these other areas and industries. The Australian government has been putting that up through its National Reconstruction Fund. They're looking at hydrogen and solar, so some subsidy. So it's, you know, we've got to have a transition, and the government has to play a role in supporting that. But ultimately, we've got to build sustainable economies based on zero emissions, and ones that are also helping us repair some of the biodiversity and nature loss as well. So it's a big transition we're undertaking.
There's also been some talk about, you know, that agriculture really can't sequester that much in the soil, you know, to make up, you know, the sort of the deficit we have. And in fact, you know, some agricultural economists and experts in the field, some of the professors at Melbourne University, are saying, you know, you probably should be using the carbon to grow better food rather than trying to sort of sell it as a carbon credit to a polluter somewhere. Is there, you know, is there an awareness that the answer, you know, can't be in the soil and in the trees, that sort of thing?
Well, I think we're getting greater literacy about all of this. And, you know, one thing everyone agrees on is more carbon in soils is actually good for productivity and for produce and the like. And then it's actually, how do you manage that? And I think this is where farmers and landholders just need to be taking good advice, really. Can they be generating that? Can they use some carbon credits and carbon revenue to slingshot their operation into a more sustainable basis, you know, recognising that there are then longer-term responsibilities to manage it? It's kind of like an easement maybe on your land. It's another land use. It can provide revenue. We shouldn't have our eyes shut to the opportunities, but also need to keep our eyes open for the risks and that need to be managed as well.
Yeah, some of the risks in the pastoral zone are just locking up the land and leaving it, and that not necessarily a great agricultural or you know, environmental outcome either.
Yeah, that's one of the things people have been concerned about. We've been looking at that in a couple of areas where carbon farming has been around for over a decade or so. We think some of the stats on that may be a bit over exaggerated, and but there's definitely been some issues. And we as the Carbon Market Institute, we do have a number of the project developers amongst our membership, and so we've been having discussions about that, how they need to be working with local communities and being open about that. And so that's certainly one of the fears that's out there. It's perhaps not as big in reality as the fears, but it's still an issue as we do that, because many of the project developers are very conscious of this. They're wanting to maximise investments in the local communities.
How are we going in terms of getting to net zero? Are we on track, or are there too many challenges in the way? How do you feel about it?
Well, Australia's emissions are still, you know, we're slowly decreasing. The projections are that from the government, and we just had a report out from the Climate Change Authority just yesterday as well, looking at the bigger picture, that's certainly within reach. The government's commitment for 43% by 2030, and the Climate Change Authority is out there saying a 65 to 75% reduction is possible by 2035. That's with a number of coal-fired power plants coming out. Of course, you're going to need extra renewables and deal with some of those transmission issues.
John Connor is the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute, and they're responsible for putting out that report about moving towards net zero. Someone's texted in to say pasture bait meat production is CO2 neutral. It's 12:15.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Let's turn our attention now to Batlow. It's been a fruitful harvest for apple growers in the Riverina Highlands. Batlow grower Greg Mowat says that the weather, labour supply and consumer demand have all worked in his favour this season. Cara Jeffrey caught up with Mr Mowat at his Batlow orchard to find out a little bit more.
It's been a good growing season. We had good rains right through November, December and January, and then it dried up in January, February, but there was sufficient moisture in the ground for us not to have to irrigate the older trees. We did irrigate the younger trees, and in the last week we've had close to 60 millimetres of rain and one very cold day where there was a bit of a dusting of snow up on the main range. But that's the autumn in Batlow. The season, I think, has been very good. One of the better ones that I can think of.
And how many apple trees do you have on your property and how many different varieties?
We've currently got around 20,000 trees and I think we've currently got about 7 different varieties, and that would be a mixture of open varieties like Pink Lady and Gala strains, but also we have some club varieties like Kansy, a new variety called Cosmic Crisp and Bravo. So, you know, they're our main varieties.
And how have consumer tastes changed in what they expect from an apple from back when it was maybe Granny Smith, Fuji and Pink Lady on the market? What do consumers want from an apple now?
Well, I think consumers have always wanted the same thing. They want a fresh, juicy, sweet apple. And so there's been a lot of change in the varieties that have been available to us. And to a degree, we're in the fashion industry. There's a lot of apple breeding going on around the world looking for specific characteristics of different apples, like sweetness and texture and colour and so on. So there's a lot of new varieties coming out every few years. They won't all make it. Some varieties go very well and other varieties fall by the wayside. But there's only such, if you come back to supermarkets, only so much space on a supermarket shelf. So if an apple's not going to make it, the supermarkets won't stock it.
For the apple industry, is there a price per kilo that growers need to be getting to remain viable?
Oh, yeah, there absolutely is. I mean, our growing costs, our inputs have gone up, fuel's gone up, power's gone up, you know, all our inputs, fertilisers have gone through the roof. So, yeah, it's becoming more and more difficult. The most important thing is for us to lift our productivity per hectare. You know, instead of producing, you know, 20 to 30 tonnes per hectare, we're looking at a minimum of 50 and upwards of that. So that's the goal for us. So, yeah, it's costly to grow fruit. Labour is very costly.
And on labour, has it been difficult to source labour this season?
We use a labour supply contractor. He has about 100 people on his books. And when we have a variety, like you can see beside me here, these Pink Ladies, they'll be picked in about 10 days to 2 weeks. And when I'm ready to pick those, I'll contact the labour supply and he will bring a team in here and knock it over. So we're quite fortunate in that regard. He's very well organised and provides very good people.
That was Batlow apple grower Greg Mowat speaking there to Cara Jeffrey about what's turning out to be a pretty good season in Batlow for apples and other things as well. It's 19 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, the Almond Board of Australia says it expects the industry to be worth $2 billion in the next 5 years with growing demand internationally and at home. The board's final report for the 23-24 season details record sales, more than 131,000 tonnes, with buyers clearing out Australia's unsold almond stock from previous seasons as well. Chief Executive Tim Jackson says the demand is being met by supply from established trees.
We had an intake of 103,000 tonnes for the year, and every year we the marketers and processors carry in stock from the previous season to ensure that there's a consistent supply. But this year we've seen, for the first time ever in the industry, we've seen our sales outstrip our annual production. So instead of 103,000 tonnes of product being sold, we've sold 131,000. So we've pretty much cleared out the warehouse for a new season.
Yeah, there you go. So was that digging into some sort of surplus product that had been, you know, ready to ship? Is that right?
That's right. A surplus product from the year before. And some of that stuff would have been potentially older material. And there are certain markets, and that's why Spain and Turkey, who do a lot of manufacturing with almonds, would have still been seen value in that product because they can value add at their end.
And what opportunity is there, you know, for demand, and will supply be sufficient to meet growing demands?
Yep. Well, we're only 10% of the global supply. California, 75%. So at the moment, we're going through a fairly flat spot around demand in regard to pricing. But the good news is, and this sort of underlines the sustainability credentials for both growers and the environment, is that, you know, any water used for growing an almond 2 years ago is still fetching a sale today. There's not too many horticultural crops that can claim that.
I'm curious also to know what factors have driven that increase in demand. Do you put it down to free trade agreements?
Certainly. Free trade agreements in China and India have played a large part in our growth in more recent times. Before the free trade agreement in China was in place, we sold about 300 tonnes into China, and last year it was 50,000, and this year with a smaller crop, that's reduced, obviously, but there's still strong demand there because of the advantage that free trade agreement provides. And in India, the biggest consumer of almonds in the world, you know, we have a 50% tariff advantage over everyone else importing almonds into India, and clearly that has doubled the amount of almonds this year, even in a small crop year, than we've had before.
Now, Tim, over the years, there have been calls for a moratorium on almond planting. But based on the recent results around demand, is there an argument that we actually need more trees in the ground to meet demand?
That's a difficult question right at the moment. There's a lot of uncertainty within the growing fraternity, not only almonds, just within horticulture with buybacks and cost of inputs and pollination availability. It's providing a little bit of uncertainty as to whether you would invest in further horticulture, well, certainly almonds at this stage, until we've got some clarity around what that looks like in the southern Murray-Darling Basin.
Now, the almond industry does get fingers pointed at it around its water efficiency. You touched just on that a bit before. We know that lots of work has been done to make plantings less thirsty, per se. What does that look like, and how can the industry shake that reputation around sustainability?
Yeah, look, it's largely a perception that is unfairly bestowed upon almonds, that we're probably one of the most sustainable industries going around. I mean, we're zero waste. Everything that's harvested off the tree is used in one shape or another, and there's not too many other industries that can actually boast that. And as I said, from a perishable point of view, almonds have got a shelf life of 2 years, can be stored for five, and, you know, they've even discovered almonds in Tutankhamun's tomb, Sophie, so that they last a while.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty incredible. Just finally, what do you expect from a financial figure for the industry to be economically contributing to the state and more broadly across Australia in the next 5 years?
With plantings in the ground, we expect that there'll be an uptick in production even further than this, the coming season, which should jump back to something like 160,000 from 103,000. But with average long-term yields, we would expect that our industry will be going close to, within the next 5 years, being a $2 billion industry.
Tim Jackson is the Chief Executive of the Almond Board of Australia. He was speaking there with Sophie Landau. You're listening to The Country Hour, 24 minutes past 12. Now, to a story that we played on Friday. In fact, last week we referred to some cuts to the local land services by the Minister, Tara Moriarty, and we also played an interview with the Minister about a range of community concerns that had been raised in regards to those changes, and also asking for a report on those changes, purporting to suggest those changes were a good idea, wanting that report to be released and finding out when it might be released. Well, the minister contacted me this morning to say that she had made changes to the board remuneration, resulting in $1.4 million in savings. We talked about some of the cuts to some of the board member payments, also the cuts to the chair's payments as well. But the minister has said that that money will go directly to the on-ground services and also to an extension of the graduate program. She said that the money, all of that money, is staying with the LLS. So it's not actually a cut to the local land services budget. All the money is staying within the LLS. But I also, I said I would make that point on the program today, but also I did say that I did ask the minister about the report that suggested those changes were a good idea, whether or not we'd get a report released to us and who actually wrote the report. But as yet, I haven't got a reply from the minister in regards to that. It's 25 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. Sydney mourns. Tributes to the six people who died in the stabbing attack at Bondi Junction shopping centre. Police are now trying to piece together what motivated the killer, Joel Cauchy. The verdict in the defamation case brought by former political staffer Bruce Lehrman. And Iran's direct attack on Israel. What is the likelihood of wider conflict in the Middle East? Those stories and much more coming up this lunchtime on The World Today.
And on the Country Hour, for thousands of years, Aboriginal nation groups journeyed to Queensland's Bunya Mountains and the Blackall Ranges, gathering where the large nut-filled cones there, weighing up to 10 kilometres, were dropping from Bunya pines, trees that, of course, tower up to 50 metres high. But the trees are under attack from dieback, which has spread from the Bunya Mountains to the Blackall Range, where Sunshine Coast rural reporter Jennifer Nichols takes up this story.
Nature lovers have long admired a magnificent stand of bunya pines on Landsborough-Mullaney Road, a popular scenic route in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. Now, most of the trees here are leafless and lifeless, sobering evidence that bunya dieback is spreading.
I was first at this site about a year ago, and there probably were about 5 out of the 11 trees that were dead, and now most of them are dead.
A senior forest pathologist with the Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, Dr. Louise Shuey, has been researching dieback in the Bunya Mountains.
It's quite heartbreaking, really.
The ancient species Araucaria bidwillii once fed dinosaurs with its spiky, football-sized cones, and has survived since the Jurassic period, dating back at least 145 million years. But in recent times, bunya pines have been under attack from microscopic invaders called Phytophthora that have been introduced since European settlement.
It's a fungal-like organism. It's not a fungus, but it's microscopic water mold that's pathogenic and lives in the soil. Amazing that something so small can take down 800-year-old trees. The way it does it is it infects through the fine feeder roots.
Dr. Louise Shuey says tests have shown that the dead stand of bunyas in Mullaney was infected by a different type of dieback than Phytophthora multivora, which has been killing both bunya and hoop pines in the Bunya Mountains.
We've detected Phytophthora cinnamomi underneath, not Phytophthora multivora. Cinnamomi tends to move more like a bulldozer through, so you don't get that patchy dieback as much. All of the trees here are dead, rather than just being patchy like it is at the Bunya Mountains.
To collaborate in the search for solutions, Bunya People's Aboriginal Corporation members travelled to Mullaney for the Beyond Bunya Dieback Symposium.
We have been calling them skeletons. The bunya trees, once they've fully gone through the infection process, they've just left a skeleton behind, so they've dropped all their limbs and leaves, as well as just a bunch of canopy missing from the rainforest, which is really sad to see.
Walking in the footsteps of his ancestors who treasured the majestic trees, Adrian Bowen says he's been been mapping dieback deaths in the section of the Bunya Mountains National Park he cares for.
And how many have you been spotting?
If I gave you a figure, it'd probably make you sad. It's everywhere.
Dr. Louise Shuey says any activity that moves soil, water or plant material can spread Phytophthora, including bushwalking, mountain biking, four-wheel driving, timber harvesting and feral pig incursions.
People do a really good job of moving Phytophthora around, so getting that message out to come clean, go clean. When you're bushwalking through a state forest, mountain biking through a state forest, make sure your gear's clean, your shoes are clean, your bike's clean. Don't go out when it's muddy.
Adrian Bowen says ignorance is no excuse, and prominent cleaning stations have been installed in the Bunya Mountains National Park.
Unfortunately, we have had people just ignore the problem. When it gets wet, that's when the dieback's spreading. So we go and close some of our tracks to stop that spread. However, we've found tracks around our washdown station, so people are just seeing the sign on, whatever, I came out to Bunya's, I'm going to enjoy it. So they'll go on the tracks anyway and spread it. And because they're not using the washdown, it's just going everywhere. It's not being managed, really. I always imagine myself walking with my old people, so, you know, I have an obligation to them to help protect this. So it really is disheartening.
Spencer and Karen Shaw from Brush Turkey Enterprises and Forest Heart Nursery organised Queensland's first dieback symposium, bringing together around 100 people, including community members and representatives from councils, national parks, landcare and conservation organisations.
That's actually what I've been really excited about. So there's a whole group of people from all these different stakeholder groups who are all concerned and have come together to share knowledge, to learn knowledge and hopefully together have some kind of action for the future.
The couple established their bush education, revegetation and restoration business 26 years ago and have watched dieback rear its ugly head on rural land historically cleared for farming.
Over the last 4 years, we've started noticing the death of bunya trees on the Blackall Range where we live. That's the communities of Mullaney and Witter and Montville in particular. The wider community is just aware that this iconic tree that's so much part of our landscape, there are some of them dying in the landscape, and that's what we're really worried about.
Bunya pines in more isolated national parks on the Blackall Range, buffered from human impact, are still looking good. The Shores believe dieback is part of a bigger picture of environmental pressures caused by clearing, soil degradation and climate change.
We can address that by better managing the landscape, by improving soil, by planting more trees, so we've got more buffering from drying winds and all that sort of stuff.
Dr. Shuey is collaborating with retired plant pathologist Ken Pegg, who developed successful treatments for Phytophthora in Australia's avocado industry. They've been injecting trees with phosphite, working with HQ Plantations, which manages around 40,000 hectares of hoop and bunya pines on state-owned land.
So phosphite, it's marketed as a fungicide, but Phytophthora is not a fungus. What it actually is a defence response stimulator. So it stimulates the plant's natural defence responses. It also, if you can get it into the roots, it acts as a barrier to the Phytophthora infecting the roots. So it doesn't actually kill the Phytophthora, but it does stop infections happening. HQ Plantations have been really helpful with this research. They've facilitated a lot of my trials of phosphite testing onto their plantation bunya and hoop pine. They've got mainly hoop pine, a few 50-year-old bunya plantations. So rather than injecting sacred trees and accidentally killing them, HQ Plantations have helped inject and trial the phosphite onto their plantation hoop pines, and we're getting really, really promising results. They're tolerating the injections really well.
As Dr. Louise Shuey is a senior forest pathologist with the Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, that report put together by Jennifer Nichols. 27 minutes to one on the Country Hour, and we'll find out what's happening with the weather. Maybe a little bit of rain on the way later on in the week. We'll find out what's happening there with the forecast. But before we do that, some news from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We'll go to the incident at Bondi first. 8 of the victims from that attack at the Westfields remain in hospital after 4 patients were discharged overnight. One patient's status has been downgraded from critical to serious, while another is no longer in a serious condition. The 9-month-old baby who was injured in the attack is in a stable condition after undergoing surgery on Saturday night. Now, the Prime Minister has confirmed the name of the 6th person who was killed in the attack. They are Yi Xuan Chung. Now, police are assisting Westfield management to arrange security on the premises as they plan to reopen. Police say around 900 to 1,500 cars left on the site have now been reclaimed by the owners, and they're currently arranging for things to reopen there. Meanwhile, the Premier has vowed to weigh up the restrictions that public security guards face with one of the victims in that attack, a security guard there who was actually on his first day. Chris Menzies today announced $18 million to establish an independent coronial inquiry into the circumstances into what happened. Now, in other news, the Bruce Lambin defamation case, the judgment is being handed down by Justice Michael Lee. It's now moved into a second hour. It was due to get underway at 10 o'clock, and not long after the judge started speaking, there was a technical issue with the feed. So it has been delayed a bit. However, it is quite a lengthy judgment, and we don't have the actual final judgment itself.
Okay. So he's saving it for later.
More to come. That's a post-lunch treat for everyone. The United Nations Secretary General has called for maximum restraint in the Middle East following Iran's attack on Israel. Antonio Guterres told a meeting of the UN Security Council that the Middle East was on the brink in the wake of Iran's drone and missile attacks against Israel. Israel's ambassador has accused Iran of being a terrorist state and has urged all of the council's members to condemn its actions. Now, the golf, Scottie Scheffler is the Masters champion. Tiger Woods set his own records. Yeah. 16 over, 304. Still got his sights set on other tournaments, apparently.
And, I'd say he had a better score than I would.
Yeah, well, who are we to talk? Jason Day was remanded for loud clothing, apparently.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Loud
The vest was a bit loud.
Is that right?
Yes.
Gee whiz. So you can go the Argyle, but you can't go anything that's a bit too colourful.
Apparently complaints from players and spectators. And
gee whiz. Reprimanded.
So, reprimanded, yes. I don't think it gets you banned, but yeah.
No. Will be fined for a reprimand?
I don't know. I'll have to go to a committee.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Augusta.
Those old boys.
That's right. Yeah, you got to watch out. Watch out for those old boys. Yeah. All right. Thanks for that. Adam Story there with the golfing news. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's 24 minutes to one. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Juan Park at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mike.
So sunny conditions for the next couple of days, but then there is a bit of a change coming on Tuesday or roundabout. What's happening later this week?
Yes, as you rightly said, we expect generally dry weather conditions in many areas, apart from some minor chance of showers or high-based thunderstorms in the state's north, but with very little rainfall, if any at all. So, generally dry weather conditions, put it that way, and with maximum temperatures, maybe low 20s in the south, tending mid to high 20s in the north. Then looking ahead from tomorrow onward, we expect a light to moderate falls in the state's northeast in the form of scattered showers or thunderstorms because of a slow-moving trough in the state's north. It will be hit and miss due to the localized nature of showers or storms. And some thunderstorms in the northeast may be severe, especially on Thursday, with a risk of locally moderate to heavy falls because that trough in the north will become mobile on Thursday. Then, suddenly wind changes will take place after the passage of the trough on Thursday. This will bring generally dry weather conditions in many areas with cooler southerly changes and apart from some coastal showers during the latter part of the week. So, in summary, yes, maybe showers or thunderstorms in the northeast expected from tomorrow through the midweek period, and then generally the clearing and the dry weather conditions during the during the latter part of the week, starting from Friday.
Right. Okay. So it sounds as though we're sort of winding back the amount of rain, and generally there's not going to be too much, and just a few hit and miss thunderstorms. Is that right? We're sort of from last week, I thought that we might be getting sort of 10 millimetres, 15 millimetres. We're not sort of going to see widespread rain to that degree.
Maybe in the states northeast, well, right. maybe a few millimeters in general, and some locations may get 10 to 20 or even more with the thunderstorms. But if that happens, it will be very much localized because of, the rain will be delivered by storms rather than, widespread rain band or anything like that. So, it will be varying place by place, but, because of the localized nature of storms, I can't promise that, you will get certain range of rainfall, so it will be hit and miss, and so we have to wait and see.
Right, and will it be reducing in rain amounts as it moves sort of further south and to the coast?
That's right, yes, because the main focus area will be the northeast quarter of the state, yes, and maybe parts of the northern inland, but along the south coast and central coast, maybe there could be some coastal showers, but probably not much, and generally anywhere west of the divide would be mostly remaining dry.
Mostly remaining dry, yeah, and sunny as well. What about looking further ahead? Are we going to move back into a dry patch again?
That's right, yes, because, once the trough clears out by late Thursday, we expect a dominance of a high-pressure system across the state. That means, apart from the very coastal areas, it will be remaining dry at least until the early next week.
Okay, so that is giving people a chance to put those crops in, get on the tractor and move around. It's things drying up a bit, so that many people will be happy about that. But after that, they wouldn't mind probably a bit of rain about Anzac Day, so we'll have to wait and see what happens there.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a fair way out of your forecast ambit, though.
Yeah, that's right. So I must say that, currently we are unable to forecast the Anzac Day conditions at this stage, but we will have some idea as we get closer to the day.
Okay, within a few days' time. Thanks for that, yeah. Juan.
My pleasure.
It's coming up to 19 minutes to 1. Well, it's still the tune that gives a lot of riders a goosebumps 24 years on. The Man from Snowy River, a theme, of course, part of the soundtrack to the Sydney 2000 Olympics opening ceremony, if you remember that. A partnership of the Australian Stock Horse Society and Polo Cross Australia. They were instrumental in having the display of Aussie stockmanship at the opening of the Sydney Games. They also organised a four-month ride, the Spring Valley Horse Ride, from Broome to Sydney that year as well. Many of the riders descended on the horse capital, Scone, in the Upper Hunter over the weekend to think back to the yesteryear as we fast approach the 2024 Paris Olympics. The Central Coast, Stephen Jeffries, was among those at the reunion. He was the lone rider, if you remember, the lone rider that went out first in the Sydney 2000 opening ceremony as 3.7 billion people around the world watched on.
As the process evolved, they decided they wanted to have a horse come out and take the limelight for a second to give the other 120 horses coming in behind an opportunity to come into the stadium. And so they wanted to have a rearing horse come out and crack a whip. And I was lucky enough to get the job to do that.
24 years on, do you still remember the nerves that were coursing through your body at that point?
Yeah, it's like yesterday, and even the music makes your hair stand up still when you hear it. It's like it's our music, and it's incredible how it stays with you.
What sort of practice went into that? I guess you were on your own in that first element, but being part of, the training that went into put on something that the world watched.
Well, it was years of work, to work out. First, we had to make the stadium where it was horse-friendly. We had to be able to hold horses in the facility there. We had to have training facilities to bring everybody together after selecting them up and down the East Coast, and transporting them, feeding the people. It was a major logistical exercise. As I say, it took years. Then once we got it together, we had boot camps where we got everybody together here in Scone, and then we moved down to Castle Hill the last 10 days. But my particular role, that was a last minute thing. That was only 3 weeks before the opening. They decided the horse that they were going to use from Movie World wasn't going to cut the mustard. It didn't look like the man from Snowy River image that they wanted to portray. So we decided to try and find a horse locally, and we did. We found Ammo. Was a very strong Australian stock horse that just he found in that last 3 weeks. He just loved to rear. He'd never done it before. He'd never been anywhere. And so it was a crash course for him.
What sort of pride do you still carry being part of that? You know, like I said before, the world was watching little old Australia put on this incredible opening ceremony. I guess tell me about the pride of being an Australian in that moment.
We were just talking about it here at the reunion. Like, because we evolved with it, we sort of took it a little bit for granted until after the event, when we saw the impact that it had on people, not just locally, but I travelled around the world after the opening doing similar things. That was an opportunity that came to me from the opening. But we ran into people all around the world that saw that opening, and the emotion of those people made you realise just how significant that opening ceremony was. Like, it really made us realise we'd done something special.
Sounds like it opened quite a lot of doors for you. What were you doing before the Olympics? Like, how did you sort of get involved?
Well, I was training horses and teaching people, always. I was a professional instructor. But what happened as a result of the Olympics, immediately after the Olympics, when they realised that that man from Snow River image hit a mark in Australia, they put together the Man from Snow River Arena Spectacular, which David Atkins and Ignatius Jones, who were the artistic people behind the horse segment, they put that arena show together to travel around Australia with Lee Kernaghan's band. We had Georgie Parker, Bud Tingwell. It was a specifically designed show that ended up being up on the Gold Coast as a permanent show there. And from there, David Atkins was doing a lot of ceremonies around the world, and so I sort of got the opportunity to go over, you know, and find camels, donkeys, horses, anything that they wanted to portray the culture of the country we were in there. Like we'd done with the stock horse in Australia, we became the go-to to find and train those groups, and it opened an amazing opportunity for us that took us to many countries.
Stephen Jeffries was the first to ride out, to canter out into the area in the opening ceremony of Sydney 2000 Olympics. He was reflecting there with Amelia Bernasconi at that reunion in Scone in the New South Wales Hunter Valley over the weekend.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A seafood supplier says he's disappointed and frustrated by a decision that won't allow any freight to be exported out of Maroombula Airport. According to Qantas's website, they're accepting import-only freight since the 6th of April. Ryan Morris, who runs the South Coast Sea Urchins in Pambula, says that he was given no notice of the change and has had a major impact on his business. He told Adrian Reardon he runs about $15,000 worth of freight business through the airport every week.
We haven't been told a great deal from Qantas at all. Apparently, Rex Air, who does the handling for the Qantas freight terminal in Maroombula, basically said that they informed Qantas a month ago that this was going to happen. They assured them that Qantas would notify the customers that this was happening, and Qantas never told us anything about it. So we relied heavily on that service. We process sea urchins, and they have a use-by date, and it's a perishable item. And when we can't get it to where it needs to go, we're really struggling. This week alone, we only found out about this on Monday when my manager tried to book some airway bills for space to Brisbane and Darwin, and couldn't do it. So he rang the airport, and that's what we were told from the airline, that they're no longer accepting any freight going outbound. So it's put us in a real position at the moment. We've had to stop processing. We've basically only processed today this week, and we still don't know how we're going to get that out at the moment. Where looks like we're going to have to drive our product up to Moruya Airport, which is also another Rex terminal. They're still accepting outbound cargo. So we're going to have to drive it 200 kilometres up to the next airport to get it out.
How long have you been using their services for?
Well, forever, basically. It's been about 15 years. They've had that service for 15 years. And we've just been export approved last year as well. So we're going to start sending product overseas into the Asian markets overseas. And at the moment, this has just put a stop to basically that as well. So it's had a massive effect. I mean, I've got 30 staff, 30 processing staff. I've probably got 10 other staff members that are related indirectly to the business. I've got divers, I've got deckhands, I've got logistics, I've got trucks and things like that, drivers. So, you know, it's not just impacting my business, but it's impacting all these other people's livelihoods.
There's Ryan Morris, who runs the South Coast's Sea Urchins in Pambula. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 10 minutes to one. Well, history may well have been made over the weekend. Snowy Valley resident completed what he reckons is a first. He's paddled a giant pumpkin down the Tumut River. Adam Farquharson has spotted the opportunity for an adventure because of a pumpkin grown by a friend, and he undertook the epic trip downriver on Saturday. And he told the ABC Riverina's Connor Burke how it all came to happen.
A mate of mine spent best part of 4 months growing an enormous pumpkin. So Mark Peacock grew this thing that was 407 kilos, and he got a blue ribbon at the Sydney show. When I saw it, I sort of asked him, what are you going to do with that thing? And he said, I don't know after that. Like, pretty much he's just going to feed the stock. And I asked him if I could paddle it. So he thought that was a great idea. So, yeah, last Friday he got his seeds out of it and relinquished it to me on Saturday morning and, paddled it down the Tumut River. They float them in America, so I was pretty confident that it was going to float, although on Friday night I thought, what if it doesn't? I suppose, getting it ready. So Mark and his dad actually carved the top out of it and took the seeds there, so they hollowed it out for me. My preps are pretty minor on the pumpkin itself, so that involved yesterday going down the catching up with it with the texture and writing Cinderella on the side, which is what I decided to call it because you got to name a boat. But my preps was that, and essentially just sort of paddling down the Tumut River in my kayak just to scout the route before I went.
Well, why Cinderella?
Oh, why not? It's a pumpkin.
And did you smash a bottle of champagne or bubbly on the side of it, or didn't go that far?
I did consider that, but I thought I'd probably knock a hole in it, so. Yeah, it was just the texture, and I got a fair bit of interest. People walking past going, is that real? And I'm like, yeah, it is real. They really couldn't believe what I was doing. Yeah. But they came down and had a look anyway. So,
well, you seem to draw quite a big crowd. Where did you get this idea from?
I think about 14 years ago, some mates of mine here, we tried to grow giant pumpkins. Mine was an abject and hilarious failure. It grew to about the size of a softball and then rotted off and died. But my plan was then to sort of try and paddle that one down the river, which was obviously never going to happen. That's sort of been, not front of mind, but yeah, when I saw this big pumpkin, I'm like, yeah, this could actually, I reckon I could do this.
So how far did you get along the river, or how far were you aiming for? Yeah, give us a bit of the route.
Yep, so we put in at where the Tumut Racecourse is, and the plan was to get down to the Pioneer Bridge, which is 1.6 km, or if you've got any older listeners, a mile.
That's Adam Farquharson, intrepid pumpkin paddler and a bit of a character, talking there to reporter Connor Burke. To Bendigo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Not good news for producers today, with the new Iran and Israel conflict in the Middle East stopping air freight and taking $20 to $40 off light and MK style lambs. Plain trade lambs under 24 kilos carcass weight also took a fair price hit of around $15 a head, while the heavier slaughter lambs over 26 kilos held up better as they are destined for other markets like the US, easing 6 to 10. Supply-wise, there was 14,500 lambs and 6,300 sheep. Heavy mutton was also 10 to 15 cheaper, while trade sheep eased 5. All up, it was a fairly erratic market, with all the talk from the buying group centred around the disruption to the Middle East, including reports some processors are having meat flown back this week that couldn't land. Heaviest export lambs over 30 kilos, 186 to a top of 236 at a ballpark cost of 640 to 650 cents. Heavy 26 to 30 kilo lambs, 156 to $195. Heavy trades, 147 to 160. These lambs averaging between 610 and 640 cents. Light lambs in the 18 to 22 kilo range, 80 to $128. Under 18 kilos, mostly $40 to $80 a head. Sheep back under $3 a kilo again. Heavy crossbred ewes, $75 to $95. Woolly merino ewes to $110. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Let's go to Corra with sheep and lambs now.
Good afternoon. Agents penned a smaller yarding for a total of 14,797 sheep and lambs. Quality was mixed with a full field of buyers present. Most categories were $10 to $20 cheaper. Heavy trade lambs slipped $7 to $11, $134 to $174. Heavy lambs were unchanged, $174 to $208. Extra heavy export types lifted $8, $210 to $223. Trade weight merino lambs slipped $5, with the top pen making $170. Light lambs were softer overall, processors paying from $78 to $118, and restockers from $59 to $118. Mutton trends were $10 to $20 softer. Heavy merino ewes sold from $84 to $115. Heavy crossbred ewes from $76 to $104. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Corowa.
To Dubbo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. A lift of 5,000 to 20,000 lambs. The quality improved, but there were still plenty of secondary lambs, but good runs of trade and heavyweights. There was an even mix of crossbreds and dorpers, while merino supported the hogget run. Light lambs and secondary trades are selling at cheaper rates, while the prime heavy trades are firm and heavy lambs are slightly dearer. Light two-score processing lambs are $25 cheaper. Lambs to 16 kilos, $46 to $88. Two scores to 18s have reached 100, and most are selling between $470 and $540. Trades 18 to 22 kilos are 20 to 25 softer on limited numbers and sold between $96 and $133, averaging $5.30 to 600 cents. The better trades, 22 to 24, 132 to 147, 24 to 26 kilos, 155 to 186, averaging 660 cents. Heavy lambs, 26 to 30 kilos, 168 to 220, averaging over 700 cents, while the extra heavies are reached 237 or 713 cents on average. The heavy hoggets are $30 cheaper, reaching 130. The balance of the lambs and 16,000 mutton are still to be sold. And this has been Graham Richard.
To Wagga Cattle.
Good afternoon. Agents yarded 5,800 cattle, 1,000 less than drawn for. Despite the shortfall, all regular buyers attended the sale and were actively participating. However, competition did fluctuate at times, leading to market correction of 20 cents with sporadic instances of greater declines. In the cow market, traction diminished considerably, with both heavy and leaner types slipping by 20 cents, with stock cow reductions of 20 to 40 cents. Prime vealers were limited in number and fetched 290 to 362. Trade heifers sold up to 295 cents, while the steer portion ranged from 328 to 335. Feedlot buyers showed reluctance towards the higher prices seen the previous week, resulting in a 20 cent decline. Medium weight sold from 270 to 367, with the occasional sale out to 374. Feeder heifers of medium weight faced weakened demand, slipping 5 to 9 cents, predominantly selling from 250 to 324. In the export market, there was occasional glimpses of price spurts, although some buyers remained subdued. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Forbes Cattle.
Numbers jumped this sale, with agents yarding 1,552 head. Quality was very mixed, with some good runs of well-bred cattle on offer, along with a larger percentage of secondary cattle penned. The usual buyers are present, competing in a variable market that saw the better bred and finished cattle holding steady. Yearling steers to feed were firm to 4 cents better, with prices ranging from 295 to 385. The better finish lines to processors reached 320. The heifer portion was 4 to 6 cents easier, processors paying from 260 to 325, while those to feed received from 250 to 324. Heavy steers and bullocks sold from 265 to 333. Grown heifers received from 240 to 265. And cows slipped 10 to 15 cents, with heavy 2 score from 208 to 225. 3 score from 238 to 252. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
Tamworth Cattle.
Good afternoon. Supply doubled, demand weakened, there were less orders in place, and quality was very mixed, with all the above impacting the market, where just over 2,700 cattle were penned. Trends were cheaper throughout, while odd selected pens of feeders sold firm. Weaner steers to restockers were down 10 cents and more, 254 to 370 cents a kilo. Heifers substantially cheaper, 30 cents at least, 238 to 310. Medium weight yearling steers, 295 to 345 cents. Heavy feeders were least affected, 294 to 360. Lightweight yearling heifers much cheaper, 175 to 276, with most of the secondary cattle under 200 cents a kilo. Medium and heavy feeder heifers sold from 260 to 320. Heavy ground steers to process reached 279 cents. The best of the ground heifers, 278. The cow market was significantly cheaper, 20 to 30 cents, with medium weight 2 and 3 scores selling from 138 to 225, while the heavy 3 and 4 scores sold from 180 to 230 cents a kilo. James Armitage for MLA in Tamworth.
It's 1 o'clock.